Chapter 18. My infatuation for the Oakland waterfront was quite dead. I didn't like the looks of it, nor the life. I didn't care for the drinking, nor the vagrancy of it, and I wandered back to the Oakland Free Library and read the books with great understanding. Then, too, my mother said I had sown my wild oats, and it was time I settled down to a regular job. Also, the family needed the money. So I got a job at the jute mills, a 10-hour day at 10 cents an hour. Despite my increase in strength and general efficiency, I was receiving no more than when I worked in the cannery several years before. But then there was a promise of a rise to $1.25 a day after a few months. And here, so far as John Barleycorn is concerned, began a period of innocence. I did not know what it was to take a drink from month end to month end. Not yet 18 years old, healthy and with labor-hardened but unhurt muscles, like any young animal, I needed diversion, excitement, something beyond the books and the mechanical toil. I strayed into young men's Christian associations. The life there was healthful and athletic, but too juvenile. For me, it was too late. I was not boy nor youth, despite my paucity of years. I had bucked big with men. I knew mysterious and violent things. I was from the other side of life so far as concerned the young men I encountered in the YMCA. I spoke another language, possessed a sadder and more terrible wisdom. When I come to think it over, I realize now that I have never had a boyhood. At any rate, the YMCA young men were too juvenile for me, too unsophisticated. This I would not have minded could they have met me and helped me mentally. But I had got more out of the books than they. Their meager physical experiences, plus their meager intellectual experiences, made a negative sum so vast that it overbalanced their wholesome morality and healthful sports. In short, I couldn't play with the pupils of a lower grade. All the clean, splendid young life that was theirs was denied me, thanks to my earlier tutelage under John Barleycorn. I knew too much too young. And yet, in the good time coming, when alcohol is eliminated from the needs and the institutions of men, it will be the YMCA and similar, unthinkably better and wiser and more virile congregating places that will receive the men who now go to saloons to find themselves and one another. In the meantime, we live today, here and now, and we discuss today, here and now. I was working 10 hours a day in the jute mills. It was humdrum machine toil. I wanted life. I wanted to realize myself in other ways than at a machine for 10 cents an hour. And yet I had had my fill of saloons. I wanted something new. I was growing up. I was developing unguessed and troubling potencies and proclivities. And at this very stage, fortunately, I met Louis Shattuck, and we became chums. Louis Shattuck, without one vicious trait, was a real, innocently devilish young fellow, who was quite convinced that he was a sophisticated town boy. And I wasn't a town boy at all. Louis was handsome and graceful and filled with love for the girls. With him it was an exciting and all-absorbing pursuit. I didn't know anything about girls. I had been too busy being a man. This was an entirely new phase of existence which had escaped me. And when I saw Louis say goodbye to me, raise his hat to a girl of his acquaintance, and walk on with her side by side down the sidewalk, I was made excited and envious. I, too, wanted to play this game. "Well, there's only one thing to do," said Louis, "and that is, you must get a girl." "Which is more difficult than it sounds. Let me show you at the expense of a slight going aside." Louis did not know girls in their home life. He had the entree to no girl's home. And, of course, I, a stranger to this new world, was similarly circumstanced. But first, Louis and I were unable to go to dancing schools or to public dances, which were very good places for getting acquainted. We didn't have the money. He was a blacksmith's apprentice and was earning but slightly more than I. We both lived at home and paid our way. When we had done this and bought our cigarettes and the inevitable clothes and shoes, there remained to each of us for personal spending a sum that varied between 70 cents and a dollar for the week. We whacked this up, shared it, and sometimes loaned all of what was left of it when one of us needed it for some more gorgeous girl adventure, such as car fare out to Blair's Park and back, 20 cents, bang, just like that, and ice cream for two, 30 cents, or tamales in a tamale parlor, which came cheaper and which for two cost only 20 cents. I did not mind this money meagerness. The disdain I had learned for money from the oyster pirates had never left me. I didn't care overweeningly for it for personal gratification. And in my philosophy, I completed the circle, finding myself as equable with the lack of a 10-cent piece as I was with the squandering of scores of dollars in calling all men and hangers-on up to the bar to drink with me. But how to get a girl? There was no girl's home to which Louis could take me and where I might be introduced to girls. I knew none, and Louis's several girls he wanted for himself. And anyway, in the very human nature of boys' and girls' ways, he couldn't turn any of them over to me. He did persuade them to bring girlfriends for me, but I found them weak sisters, pale and ineffectual alongside the choice specimens he had. "You'll have to do like I did," he said finally. "I got there by getting them. You'll have to get one the same way." And he initiated me. It must be remembered that Louis and I were hard situated. We really had to struggle to pay our board and maintain a decent appearance. We met each other in the evening after the day's work on the street corner, or in a little candy store on a side street, our sole frequenting place. Here we bought our cigarettes and, occasionally, a nickel's worth of red hots. Oh, yes, Louis and I unblushingly ate candy, all we could get. Neither of us drank, neither of us ever went into a saloon. But the girl. In quite primitive fashion, as Louis advised me, I was to select her and make myself acquainted with her. We strolled the streets in the early evenings. The girls, like us, strolled in pairs. and strolling girls will look at strolling boys who look. And to this day, in any town, city, or village in which I, in my middle age, find myself, I look on with the eye trained of old experience and watch the sweet innocent game played by the strolling boys and girls who just must stroll when the spring and summer evenings call. The trouble was that in this Arcadian phase of my history, I, who had come through case-hardened from the other side of life, was timid and bashful. Again and again, Lewis nerved me up. But I didn't know girls. They were strange and wonderful to me after my precious man's life. I failed of the bold front and the necessary forwardness when the crucial moment came. Then Lewis would show me how. A certain eloquent glance of eye, a smile, a daring, a lifted hat, a spoken word, hesitancies, giggles, coy nervousness, and, behold, Lewis acquainted and nodding me up to be introduced. But when we paired off to stroll along, boy and girl together, I noted that Lewis invariably picked the good looker and left me the little lame sister. I improved, of course, after experiences too numerous to enter upon, so that there were diverse girls to whom I could lift my hat and who would walk beside me in the early evenings. But girls' love did not immediately come to me. I was excited, interested, and I pursued the quest. And the thought of drink never entered my mind. Some of Lewis's and my adventures have since given me serious pause when casting sociological generalizations. But it was all good and innocently youthful, and I learned one generalization, biological rather than sociological, namely, that the Colonel's Lady and Judy O'Grady are sisters under their skins. And before long I learned girls' love, all the dear fond deliciousness of it, all the glory and the wonder. I shall call her Haiti. She was between 15 and 16. Her little skirt reached her shoe tops. We sat side by side in a Salvation Army meeting. She was not a convert, nor was her aunt who sat on the other side of her, and who, visiting from the country when at that time the Salvation Army was not, had dropped in to the meeting for half an hour out of curiosity. And Lewis sat beside me and observed, I do believe he did no more than observe, because Haiti was not his style of girl. We did not speak, but in that great half-hour we glanced shyly at each other and shyly avoided or as shyly returned and met each other's glances more than several times. She had a slender oval face. Her brown eyes were beautiful. Her nose was a dream, as was her sweet-lipped, petulant-hinting mouth. She wore a tam-o'-shanter, and I thought her brown hair the prettiest shade of brown I had ever seen. And from that single experience of half an hour, I have ever since been convinced of the reality of love at first sight. All too soon the aunt and Haiti departed. This is permissible at any stage of a Salvation Army meeting. I was no longer interested in the meeting, and after an appropriate interval of a couple of minutes or less, started to leave with Lewis. As we passed out, at the back of the hall, a woman recognized me with her eyes, arose, and followed me. I shall not describe her. She was of my own kind and friendship of the old time on the waterfront. When Nelson was shot, he had died in her arms, and she knew me as his one comrade. And she must tell me how Nelson had died, and I did want to know. So I went with her across the width of life, from dawning boy's love for a brown-haired girl in a tam-o'-shanter, back to the old sad savagery I had known. And when I had heard the tale, I hurried away to find Lewis, fearing that I had lost my first love with the first glimpse of her. But Lewis was dependable. Her name was Haiti. He knew where she lived. Each day she passed the blacksmith shop where he worked, going to and from the Lafayette School. Further, he had seen her on occasion with Ruth, another schoolgirl, and still further, Nita, who sold us red hots at the candy store, was a friend of Ruth. The thing to do was to go around to the candy store and see if we could get Nita to give a note to Ruth to give to Haiti. If this could be arranged, all I had to do was write the note. And it so happened. And in stolen half hours of meeting, I came to know all the sweet madness of boys' love and girls' love. So far as it goes, it is not the biggest love in the world, but I do dare to assert that it is the sweetest. Oh, as I look back on it, never did girl have more innocent boy lover than I, who had been so wicked wise and violent beyond my years. I didn't know the first thing about girls. I, who had been hailed Prince of the Oyster Pirates, who could go anywhere in the world as a man amongst men, who could sail boats, lay aloft in black and storm, or go into the toughest hangouts in Sailor Town and play my part in any rough house that started or call all hands to the bar, I didn't know the first thing I might say or do with this slender little chit of a girl-woman whose scant skirt just reached her shoe-tops and who was as abysmally ignorant of life as I was, or thought I was, profoundly wise. I remembered we sat on a bench in the starlight. There was fully a foot of space between us. We slightly faced each other, our near elbows on the back of the bench, and once or twice our elbows just touched, and all the time deliriously happy, talking in the gentlest and most delicate terms that might not offend her sensitive ears, I was cudgeling my brains in an effort to divine what I was expected to do. What did girls expect of boys, sitting on a bench and tentatively striving to find out what love was? What did she expect me to do? Was I expected to kiss her? Did she expect me to try? And if she did expect me, and I didn't, what would she think of me? Ah, she was wiser than I. I know it now. The little innocent girl-woman in her shoe-top skirt. She had known boys all her life. She encouraged me in the ways a girl may. Her gloves were off and in one hand, and I remember, lightly and daringly, in mock reproof for something I had said, how she tapped my lips with a tiny flirt of those gloves. I was like to swoon with delight. It was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to me. And I remember yet the faint scent that clung to those gloves and that I breathed in the moment they touched my lips. Then came the agony of apprehension and doubt. Should I imprison in my hand that little hand with the dangling scented gloves which had just tapped my lips? Should I dare to kiss her there and then, or slip my arm around her waist? Or dared I even sit closer? Well, I didn't dare. I did nothing. I merely continued to sit there and love with all my soul. And when we parted that evening, I had not kissed her. I do remember the first time I kissed her, on another evening at parting, a mighty moment, when I took all my heart of courage and dared. We never succeeded in managing more than a dozen stolen meetings, and we kissed perhaps a dozen times, as boys and girls kiss, briefly and innocently and wonderingly. We never went anywhere, not even to a matinee. We once shared together 5 cents worth of red hots, but I have always fondly believed that she loved me. I know I loved her, and I dreamed daydreams of her for a year or more. And the memory of her is very dear. Chapter 19. When I was with people who did not drink, I never thought of drinking. Lewis did not drink. Neither he nor I could afford it, but more significant than that, we had no desire to drink. We were healthy, normal, non-alcoholic. Had we been alcoholic, we would have drunk whether or not we could have afforded it. Each night after the day's work, washed up, clothes changed, and supper eaten, we met on the street corner or in the little candy store. But the warm fall weather passed, and on bitter nights of frost or damp nights of drizzle, the street corner was not a comfortable meeting place. And the candy store was unheated. Nita, or whoever waited on the counter, between waitings lurked in a back living room that was heated. We were not admitted to this room, and in the store it was as cold as out of doors. Lewis and I debated the situation. There was only one solution. The saloon, the congregating place of men. The place where men hobnobbed with John Barleycorn. Well do I remember the damp and drafty evening, shivering without overcoats because we could not afford them, that Lewis and I started out to select our saloon. Saloons are always warm and comfortable. Now Lewis and I did not go into this saloon because we wanted a drink. Yet we knew that saloons were not charitable institutions. A man could not make a lounging place of a saloon without occasionally buying something over the bar. Our dimes and nickels were few. We could ill spare any of them when they were so potent in paying car fare for oneself and a girl. We never paid car fare when by ourselves, being content to walk. So in this saloon, we desired to make the most of our expenditure. We called for a deck of cards and sat down at a table and played euchre for an hour, in which time Lewis treated once and I treated once to beer, the cheapest drink, 10 cents for two. Prodigal, how we grudged it. We studied the men who came into the place. They seemed all middle-aged and elderly workmen, most of them German, who flocked by themselves in old acquaintance groups, and with whom we could have only the slightest contacts. We voted against that saloon and went out cast down with the knowledge that we had lost an evening and wanted 20 cents for beer that we didn't want. We made several more tries on succeeding nights and at last found our way into the National, a saloon on 10th and Franklin. Here was a more congenial crowd. Here Lewis met a fellow or two he knew, and here I met fellows I had gone to school with when a little lad in knee pants. We talked of old days and of what had become of this fellow and what that fellow was doing now, and of course we talked it over drinks. They treated and we drank. Then, according to the code of drinking, we had to treat. It hurt, for it meant 40 to 50 cents a clatter. We felt quite enlivened when the short evening was over, but at the same time we were bankrupt. Our week's spending money was gone. We decided that that was the saloon for us, and we agreed to be more circumspect thereafter in our drink buying. Also, we had to economize for the rest of the week. We didn't even have carfare. We were compelled to break an engagement with two girls from West Oakland with whom we were attempting to be in love. They were to meet us uptown the next evening, and we hadn't the carfare necessary to take them home. Like many others financially embarrassed, we had to disappear for a time from the gay whirl, at least until Saturday night payday. So Lewis and I rendezvoused in a livery stable, and with coats buttoned and chattering teeth, played euchre and casino until the time of our exile was over. Then we returned to the National Saloon and spent no more than we could decently avoid spending for the comfort and warmth. Sometimes we had mishaps, as when one got stuck twice in succession in a five-handed game of Sancho Pedro for the drinks. Such a disaster meant anywhere between 25 to 80 cents, just according to how many of the players ordered 10-cent drinks. But we could temporarily escape the evil effects of such disaster by virtue of an account we ran behind the bar. Of course, this only set back the day of reckoning and seduced us into spending more than we could have spent on a cash basis. When I left Oakland suddenly for the adventure path the following spring, I well remember I owed that saloon keeper $1.70. Long after, when I returned, he was gone. I still owe him that $1.70, and if he should chance to read these lines, I want him to know that I'll pay on demand. The foregoing incident of the National Saloon I have given in order again to show the lure, or draw, or compulsion toward John Barleycorn in society as at present organized, with saloons on all the corners. Lewis and I were two healthy youths. We didn't want to drink. We couldn't afford to drink. And yet we were driven by the circumstance of cold and rainy weather to seek refuge in a saloon where we had to spend part of our pitiful dole for drink. It will be urged by some critics that we might have gone to the YMCA, to night school, and to the social circles and homes of young people. The only reply is that we didn't. That is the irrefragable fact. We didn't. And today, at this moment, there are hundreds of thousands of boys like Lewis and me doing just what Lewis and I did with John Barleycorn, warm and comfortable, beckoning and welcoming, tucking their arms in his and beginning to teach them his mellow ways. Chapter 20. The jute mills failed of its agreement to increase my pay to $1.25 a day, and I, a free-born American boy whose direct ancestors had fought in all the wars, from the old pre-revolutionary Indian wars down, exercised my sovereign right of free contract by quitting the job. I was still resolved to settle down, and I looked about me. One thing was clear: unskilled labor didn't pay. I must learn a trade, and I decided on electricity. The need for electricians was constantly growing. But how to become an electrician? I hadn't the money to go to a technical school or university. Besides, I didn't think much of schools. I was a practical man in a practical world. Also, I still believed in the old myths which were the heritage of the American boy when I was a boy. A canal boy could become a president. Any boy who took employment with any firm could, by thrift, energy, and sobriety, learn the business and rise from position to position until he was taken in as a junior partner. After that, the senior partnership was only a matter of time. Very often, so ran the myth, the boy, by reason of his steadiness and application, married his employer's daughter. By this time, I had been encouraged to such faith in myself in the matter of girls that I was quite certain I would marry my employer's daughter. There wasn't a doubt of it. All the little boys in the myths did it as soon as they were old enough. So I bade farewell forever to the adventure path, and went out to the power plant of one of our Oakland Street railways. I saw the superintendent himself in a private office so fine that it almost stunned me. But I talked straight up. I told him I wanted to become a practical electrician, that I was unafraid of work, that I was used to hard work, and that all he had to do was look at me to see I was fit and strong. I told him that I wanted to begin right at the bottom and work up, that I wanted to devote my life to this one occupation and this one employment. The superintendent beamed as he listened. He told me that I was the right stuff for success, and that he believed in encouraging American youth that wanted to rise. Why, employers were always on the lookout for young fellows like me, and alas, they found them all too rarely. My ambition was fine and worthy, and he would see to it that I got my chance. And as I listened with swelling heart, I wondered if it was his daughter I was to marry. Before you can go out on the road and learn the more complicated and higher details of the profession, he said, you will, of course, have to work in the car house with the men who install and repair the motors. By this time, I was sure that it was his daughter, and I was wondering how much stock he might own in the company. But, he said, as you yourself so plainly see, you couldn't expect to begin as a helper to the car house electricians. That will come when you have worked up to it. You will really begin at the bottom. In the car house, your first employment will be sweeping up, washing the windows, keeping things clean. And after you have shown yourself satisfactory at that, then you may become a helper to the car house electricians. I didn't see how sweeping and scrubbing a building was any preparation for the trade of electrician, but I did know that in the books all the boys started with the most menial tasks, and by making good ultimately won to the ownership of the whole concern. "When shall I come to work?" I asked, eager to launch on this dazzling career. "But," said the superintendent, "as you and I have already agreed, you must begin at the bottom. Not immediately can you in any capacity enter the car house. Before that, you must pass through the engine room as an oiler." My heart went down slightly, and for the moment, as I saw the road lengthen between his daughter and me, then it rose again. I would be a better electrician with knowledge of steam engines. As an oiler in the great engine room, I was confident that few things concerning steam would escape me. Heavens! My career shone more dazzling than ever. "When shall I come to work?" I asked gratefully. "But," said the superintendent, "you could not expect to enter immediately into the engine room. There must be preparation for that. And through the fire room, of course." "Come, you see the matter clearly, I know. And you will see that even the mere handling of coal, it is a scientific matter and not to be sneered at. Do you know that we weigh every pound of coal we burn? Thus, we learn the value of the coal we buy. We know to a T the last penny of cost of every item of production, and we learn which firemen are the most wasteful. Which firemen, out of stupidity or carelessness, get the least out of the coal they fire." The superintendent beamed again. "You see how very important the little matter of coal is, and by as much as you learn of this little matter, you will become that much better a workman. More valuable to us, more valuable to yourself. Now, are you prepared to begin?" "Anytime," I said valiantly, "the sooner the better." "Very well," he answered. "You will come tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. I was taken out and shown my duties. Also, I was told the terms of my employment. A 10-hour day, every day in the month, including Sundays and holidays, with one day off each month, with a salary of $30 a month. It wasn't exciting. Years before, at the cannery, I had earned $1 a day for a 10-hour day. I consoled myself with the thought that the reason my earning capacity had not increased with my years and strength was because I had remained an unskilled laborer. But it was different now. I was beginning to work for skill, for a trade, for career and fortune, and the superintendent's daughter. And I was beginning in the right way, right at the beginning. That was the thing. I was passing coal to the firemen, who shoveled it into the furnaces, where its energy was transformed into steam, which, in the engine room, was transformed into the electricity with which the electricians worked. This passing coal was purely the very beginning, unless the superintendent should take it into his head to send me to work in the mines from which the coal came in order to get a completer understanding of the genesis of electricity for street railways. Work! I, who had worked with men, found that I didn't know the first thing about real work. A 10-hour day! I had to pass coal for the day and night shifts, and despite working through the noon hour, I never finished my task before 8 at night. I was working a 12 or 13-hour day, and I wasn't being paid overtime as in the cannery. I might as well give the secret away right here. I was doing the work of two men. Before me, one mature, able-bodied laborer had done the day shift, and another equally mature, able-bodied laborer had done the night shift. They had received $40 a month each. The superintendent, bent on an economical administration, had persuaded me to do the work of both men for $30 a month. I thought he was making an electrician of me. In truth and fact, he was saving $50 a month operating expenses to the company. But I didn't know I was displacing two men. Nobody told me. On the contrary, the superintendent warned everybody not to tell me. How valiantly I went at it that first day. I worked at top speed, filling the iron wheelbarrow with coal, running it on the scales and weighing the load, then trundling it into the fire room and dumping it on the plates before the fires. Work! I did more than the two men whom I had displaced. They had merely wheeled in the coal and dumped it on the plates. But while I did this for the day coal, the night coal I had to pile against the wall of the fire room. Now the fire room was small. It had been planned for a night coal passer. So I had to pile the night coal higher and higher, buttressing up the heap with stout planks. Toward the top of the heap, I had to handle the coal a second time, tossing it up with a shovel. I dripped with sweat, but I never ceased from my stride, though I could feel exhaustion coming on. By 10 o'clock in the morning, so much of my body's energy had I consumed, I felt hungry and snatched a thick double slice of bread and butter from my dinner pail. This I devoured, standing, grimed with coal dust, my knees trembling under me. By 11 o'clock, in this fashion, I had consumed my whole lunch. But what of it? I realized that it would enable me to continue working through the noon hour. And I worked all the afternoon. Darkness came on, and I worked under the electric lights. The day fireman went off, and the night fireman came on. I plugged away. At 8:30, famished, tottering, I washed up, changed my clothes, and dragged my weary body to the car. It was 3 miles to where I lived, and I had received a pass with the stipulation that I could sit down as long as there were no paying passengers in need of a seat. As I sank into a corner outside seat, I prayed that no passenger might require my seat. But the car filled up, and halfway in, a woman came on board, and there was no seat for her. I started to get up, and to my astonishment found that I could not. With the chill wind blowing on me, my spent body had stiffened into the seat. It took me the rest of the run in to unkink my complaining joints and muscles and get into a standing position on the lower ramp. And when the car stopped at my corner, I nearly fell to the ground when I stepped off. I hobbled two blocks to the house and limped into the kitchen. While my mother started to cook, I plunged into bread and butter. But before my appetite was appeased, or the steak fried, I was sound asleep. In vain my mother strove to shake me awake enough to eat the meat. Failing in this, with the assistance of my father, she managed to get me to my room, where I collapsed dead asleep on the bed. They undressed me and covered me up. In the morning came the agony of being awakened. I was terribly sore, and worst of all, my wrists were swelling. But I made up for my lost supper, eating an enormous breakfast, and when I hobbled to catch my car, I carried a lunch twice as big as the one the day before. Work! Let any youth just turned 18 try to out-shovel two man-grown coal shovelers. Work! Long before midday, I had eaten the last scrap of my huge lunch. But I was resolved to show them what a husky young fellow determined to rise could do. The worst of it was that my wrists were swelling and going back on me. There are few who do not know the pain of walking on a sprained ankle. Then imagine the pain of shoveling coal and trundling a loaded wheelbarrow with two sprained wrists. Work! More than once I sank down on the coal where no one could see me and cried with rage and mortification and exhaustion and despair. That second day was my hardest, and all that enabled me to survive it and get in the last of the night coal at the end of 13 hours was the day fireman, who bound both my wrists with broad leather straps. So tightly were they buckled that they were like slightly flexible plaster casts. They took the stresses and pressures which hitherto had been borne by my wrists, and they were so tight that there was no room for the inflammation to rise in the sprains. And in this fashion, I continued to learn to be an electrician. Night after night, I limped home, fell asleep before I could eat my supper, and was helped into bed and undressed. Morning after morning, always with hunger lunches in my dinner pail, I limped out of the house on my way to work. I no longer read my library books. I made no dates with the girls. I was a proper work beast. I worked and ate and slept, while my mind slept all the time. The whole thing was a nightmare. I worked every day, including Sunday, and I looked far ahead to my one day off at the end of a month, resolved to lie abed all that day and just sleep and rest up. The strangest part of this experience was that I never took a drink nor thought of taking a drink. Yet I knew that men under hard pressure almost invariably drank. I had seen them do it, and in the past had often done it myself. But so sheerly non-alcoholic was I that it never entered my mind that a drink might be good for me. I instance this to show how entirely lacking from my makeup was any predisposition toward alcohol. And the point of this instance is that later on, after more years had passed, contact with John Barleycorn at last did induce in me the alcoholic desire. I had often noticed the day fireman staring at me in a curious way. At last, one day, he spoke. He began by swearing me to secrecy. He had been warned by the superintendent not to tell me, and in telling me, he was risking his job. He told me of the day coal passer and the night coal passer, and of the wages they had received. I was doing for $30 a month what they had received $80 for doing. He would have told me sooner, the fireman said, had he not been so certain that I would break down under the work and quit. As it was, I was killing myself, and all to no good purpose. I was merely cheapening the price of labor, he argued, and keeping two men out of a job. Being an American boy, and a proud American boy, I did not immediately quit. This was foolish of me, I know, but I resolved to continue the work long enough to prove to the superintendent that I could do it without breaking down. Then I would quit, and he would realize what a fine young fellow he had lost. All of which I faithfully and foolishly did. I worked on until the time came when I got in the last of the night coal by 6 o'clock. Then I quit the job of learning electricity by doing more than two men's work for a boy's wages, went home, and proceeded to sleep the clock round. Fortunately, I had not stayed by the job long enough to injure myself, though I was compelled to wear straps on my wrists for a year afterward. But the effect of this work orgy in which I had indulged was to sicken me with work. I just wouldn't work. The thought of work was repulsive. I didn't care if I never settled down. Learning a trade could go hang. It was a whole lot better to roister and frolic over the world in the way I had previously done. So I headed out on the adventure path again, starting to tramp east by beating my way on the railroads. Chapter 21. But behold, as soon as I went out on the adventure path, I met John Barleycorn again. I moved through a world of strangers, and the act of drinking together made one acquainted with men and opened the way to adventures. It might be in a saloon with jingled townsmen, or with a genial railroad man well lighted up and armed with pocket flasks, or with a bunch of alky stiffs in a hangout. Yes, and it might be in a prohibition state, such as Iowa was in 1894, when I wandered up the main street of Des Moines and was variously invited by strangers into various blind pigs. I remember drinking in barber shops, plumbing establishments, and furniture stores. Always it was John Barleycorn. Even a tramp in those halcyon days could get most frequently drunk. I remember inside the prison at Buffalo how some of us got magnificently jingled, and how, on the streets of Buffalo after our release, another jingle was financed with pennies begged on the main drag. I had no call for alcohol, but when I was with those who drank, I drank with them. I insisted on traveling or loafing with the livest, keenest men, and it was just these live, keen ones that did most of the drinking. They were the more comradely men, the more venturous, the more individual. Perhaps it was too much temperament that made them turn from the commonplace and humdrum to find relief in lying and fantastic sureties of John Barleycorn. Be that as it may, the men I liked best, desired most to be with, were invariably to be found in John Barleycorn's company. In the course of my tramping over the United States, I achieved a new concept. As a tramp, I was behind the scenes of society, aye, and down in the cellar. I could watch the machinery work. I saw the wheels of the social machine go around, and I learned that the dignity of manual labor wasn't what I had been told it was by the teachers, preachers, and politicians. The men without trades were helpless cattle. If one learned a trade, he was compelled to belong to a union in order to work at his trade. And his union was compelled to bully and slug the employer's unions in order to hold up wages or hold down hours. The employer's unions likewise bullied and slugged. I couldn't see any dignity at all. And when a workman got old or had an accident, he was thrown into the scrap heap like any worn-out machine. I saw too many of this sort who were making anything but dignified ends of life. So my new concept was that manual labor was undignified and that it didn't pay. No trade for me was my decision, and no superintendent's daughters. And no criminality, I also decided. That would be almost as disastrous as to be a laborer. Brains paid, not brawn, and I resolved never again to offer my muscles for sale in the brawn market. Brain and brain only would I sell. I returned to California with the firm intention of developing my brain. This meant school education. I had gone through the grammar school long ago, so I entered the Oakland High School. To pay my way, I worked as a janitor. My sister helped me, too. And I was not above mowing anybody's lawn or taking up and beating carpets when I had half a day to spare. I was working to get away from work. And I buckled down to it with a grim realization of the paradox. Boy and girl love was left behind, and along with it, Haiti and Louis Shattuck, and the early evening strolls. I hadn't the time. I joined the Henry Clay Debating Society. I was received into the homes of some of the members, where I met nice girls whose skirts reached the ground. I dallied with little home clubs wherein we discussed poetry and art and the nuances of grammar. I joined the Socialist Local, where we studied and orated political economy, philosophy, and politics. I kept half a dozen membership cards working in the free library and did an immense amount of collateral reading. And for a year and a half on end, I never took a drink, nor thought of taking a drink. I hadn't the time, and I certainly did not have the inclination. Between my janitor work, my studies, and innocent amusements such as chess, I hadn't a moment to spare. I was discovering a new world, and such was the passion of my exploration that the old world of John Barleycorn held no inducements for me. Come to think of it, I did enter a saloon. I went to see Johnny Heinhold in the last chance, and I went to borrow money. And right here is another phase of John Barleycorn. Saloon keepers are notoriously good fellows. On an average, they perform vastly greater generosities than do businessmen. When I simply had to have $10, desperate, with no place to turn, I went to see Johnny Heinhold. Several years had passed since I had been in his place or spent a cent across his bar. And when I went to borrow the $10, I didn't buy a drink either. And Johnny Heinhold let me have the $10 without security or interest. More than once, in the brief days of my struggle for an education, I went to see Johnny Heinhold to borrow money. When I entered the university, I borrowed $40 from him, without interest, without security, without buying a drink. And yet, and here is the point, the custom and the code, in the days of my prosperity, after the lapse of years, I have gone out of my way by many a long block to spend across Johnny Heinhold's bar deferred interest on the various loans. Not that Johnny Heinhold asked me to do it or expected me to do it. I did it, as I have said, in obedience to the code I have learned along with all the other things connected with John Barleycorn. In distress, when a man has no other place to turn, when he hasn't the slightest bit of security which a savage-hearted pawnbroker would consider, he can go to some saloon keeper he knows. Gratitude is inherently human. When the man so helped has money again, depend upon it that a portion will be spent across the bar of the saloon keeper who befriended him. Why, I recollect the early days of my writing career, when the small sums of money I earned from the magazines came with tragic irregularity, while at the same time I was staggering along with a growing family, a wife, children, a mother, a nephew, and my Mammy Jenny and her old husband fallen on evil days. There were two places at which I could borrow money, a barber shop and a saloon. The barber charged me 5% per month in advance. That is to say, when I borrowed $100, he handed me $95. The other $5 he retained as advance interest for the first month. And on the second month, I paid him $5 more, and continued to do so each month until I made a 10-strike with the editors and lifted the loan. The other place to which I came in trouble was the saloon. The saloon keeper I had known by sight for a couple of years. I had never spent my money in his saloon, and even when I borrowed from him, I didn't spend any money. Yet never did he refuse me any sum I asked of him. Unfortunately, before I became prosperous, he moved away to another city, and to this day I regret that he is gone. It is the code I have learned, the right thing to do, and the right thing I do right now, did I know where he is, would be to drop in on occasion and spend a few dollars across his bar for old sake's sake and gratitude. This is not to exalt saloon keepers. I have written it to exalt the power of John Barleycorn, and to illustrate one more of the myriad ways by which a man is brought in contact with John Barleycorn until in the end he finds he cannot get along without him. But to return to the run of my narrative. Away from the adventure path, up to my ears in study, every moment occupied, I lived oblivious to John Barleycorn's existence. Nobody about me drank. If any had drunk, and had they offered it to me, I surely would have drunk. As it was, when I had spare moments, I spent them playing chess, or going with nice girls who were themselves students, or in riding a bicycle whenever I was fortunate enough to have it out of the pawnbroker's possession. What I am insisting upon all the time is this. In me was not the slightest trace of alcoholic desire, and this despite the long and severe apprenticeship I had served under John Barleycorn. I had come back from the other side of life to be delighted with this Arcadian simplicity of student youths and student maidens. Also, I had found my way into the realm of the mind, and I was intellectually intoxicated. Alas, as I was to learn at a later period, intellectual intoxication, too, has its katzenjammer.